You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to The Anarchaeologist, bringing you the best in archaeology podcasting. We are part of the Archaeology Podcast Network, and today we're going to talk about something a little bit different. This is electric archaeology? Whatever that is. Well, we're going to find out what that is. Today's guest is Sean Graham, whose blog Electric Archaeology has a lot of different things on it. It's quite an interesting conversation, and we'll get to it right about now. I want to first introduce Sean. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So obviously, electric archaeology, as you just described, is a kind of a mix. It's very different to other things, and you kind of, you almost admit it, you didn't really know why you started. So, anyway, obviously it's a really great blog, and I advise everybody to go and check it out. But I mean, what do you envisage it to hold in the future? Like, what kind of things are you looking, kind of, do you think about for your blog?
Well, I like to, I say to some of my students in my class, I will say to them, you know, welcome to the next 12 weeks of things that Dr. Graham thinks are cool. And the blog is a bit like that. It captures my, I think of it as an open notebook these days, of things that I'm working on, things that I'm interested in, things I'm intrigued by. And if you look at its evolution over the last, I can't do math in my head, but many years.
It's okay. I can't do math either.
I was trying. I had to start counting on my fingers. And but basically, it's always been a snapshot of just what I've been, what's captured my interest, what I thought was worth exploring. I get a bit of a kick out of figuring out how to do things, and then telling other folks how to do it. I guess it's not for nothing, I suppose, that my Twitter avatar is a minion, but it's where it's going in the future. I don't know. I like using it to highlight the work that my students are doing now. Of course, when I started it, I didn't have students. I was off in the academic wilderness. I was hustling to make ends meet. So it was really just, it was a blog just for me to make me feel like I was academic and contributing to the wider world somehow. And astonishingly, people found it and found value in it and found useful things in it. And it directly contributed to my current position. I don't think I would have gotten the job if I hadn't have started giving away everything on the blog.
Yeah.
You can't hoard stuff. So I gave it away, and it actually came back to me, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. No, that's one of the great conversations right now, especially about open access archaeology. You know, talking about, you know, making stuff available for everyone is beneficial to everyone. Although there's always, you know, the old fogies who just want to hold on to that precious, precious knowledge. But don't worry, people like us, we'll spread it out, spread it to all the ends of the earth. There's an interesting point, and it's something I've hit into over the last number of months, is what is digital archaeology? Because digital archaeology, for one person, means doing digital reconstructions. Another person, it means digging through a hard disk. A third person is says, you know, oh, it's just going back through archives on the internet. You know, so, like, I mean, you know, am I making sense here about the problem with digital archaeology? What does it mean? So it would be cool to hear what your opinion is, and why did you call yourself, or your blog, Electric Archaeology?
I started blogging in 2006. I suppose. And I had graduated with my PhD in 2002, and the demand for Roman stamp brick specialists in Eastern Canada was rather thin on the ground at the time, as you can imagine.
I like that.
I did a stint teaching high school for a while and doing heritage consulting and different things. And in about 2005, I persuaded Professor Leah Sterling at the University of Manitoba that archaeological agent-based simulation of Roman society would be a good thing to do. And so she brought me out to Winnipeg, and I spent a great year building simulations and models and that sort of thing. And I had a very static and very boring web page to disseminate my models and to communicate my code and so on and so forth. But I lucked out tremendously. A fellow at Brock University in Ontario, John Bonnet, saw that, came out to the CAA in Fargo in 2006 to hear me talk about these things. And he started passing me job notices and information, calls for papers, that sort of thing, connected with this new digital humanities shtick. And one of those that came through was for the first digital humanities workshop at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. So I went to that to show off how I, my practical necromancy with agent-based models. And I met Alan Liu there and Thomas Ayers and lots of really important folks who said, "We really like your stuff, but why aren't you blogging this? What's wrong with you?" They didn't put it quite like that, but the essence was, if you're not making your stuff public in a way that people can find it, then why bother? Who are you talking to? Who are you reaching? And so I sat down and started thinking, okay, well, blogging, all right. Well, I want to blog about my agent models and so on and so forth. And electric archaeology just seemed to roll off the tongue nicely. I like the glottal stops there and the vowels. And that's a very long-winded way of saying I don't really remember why I called it electric archaeology. Although I didn't want to call it digital archaeology because that seemed limiting in a way. Electric carries that connotation of things that are exciting and that things that are supercharged and things that might go off madly in all sorts of different directions, whereas digital makes me think of fingers and hands and there's craft involved in that. But the electric archaeology seemed a better fit for what I do. And I've been told there's people who are topic modeling a bunch of different blogs, and they have told me that my blog has many, many, many topics in it. So it's not, you know, the advice you get about blogging is to keep on a topic and keep focused and all that sort of thing. And I'm all over the place.
Now, you were also involved with a few other like online things and websites, including Play the Past. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Play the Past is a tremendous site. It's a group-authored blog. There's about 20 of us on there at the moment, I think. It was put together by Ethan Wattrell at MSU in the States in 2010, I suppose, 2011. And it was a place for archaeologists, historians. There's a couple of English folks. To talk about the creative engagement with history, heritage, material culture, museums, archives, you name it. And it's been hugely successful. I've seen it cited in papers. If you look at our visitor stats, we're always getting lots of traffic, lots of people reading it. I've assigned a number of essays from Play the Past onto syllabi. I've seen people float essays on the site and then later turn them into published articles in collections or journals. I think, with no false modesty, I think it's probably one of the best places to go on the web for people who are interested in this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Well, I mean, if you say it's great, it's got to be great, eh?
Well, damn straight.
And of course, it's a topic that's been reached many times on this podcast. We've had, I don't know if you know Andrew Reinhard.
Yeah.
He's made quite a few, he's been on a few shows here. We kind of love him for some reason. He just keeps coming back. He's punked his way into our hearts. And as always, it's a really, really cool thing from my point of view, because I think I was a gamer at one point, not sure right now because of everything else, but I'm a big fan. I don't know, are you a gamer?
Well, I play games. I don't identify with the gamer mindset as evidenced through social media.
Okay. Obviously, that's, yeah, recently it's been a bit all over the place,
hasn't it? I like to think about that.
Yeah. But you play video games, right? Play video games.
Oh, yeah. I teach a class where we write video games.
That is really cool. Honestly, like so what do you usually code in? Like how do you make, or what do you kind of do with the video games? Like, tell me about this class.
Okay, well, it's History 3812A at Carleton University, and you have to take students on an evolution, right? Because we as a culture, as a society, have done a really good job of hammering into people's heads that historians write essays and that is all that they shall do. And if they make films or documentaries, then they're somehow sellouts or less serious or popularizing. So in 3812, I framed the whole class as an exploration of how do we write good history through gaming? How do we write scholarship? So it's not about studying the representation of the past in video games. It's not about teaching people about the past through video games. It's about actually figuring out how to write about the past in the same way you would make an argument in an essay, and we teach you how to do that. I'm going to teach you how to make an argument through games. So we do a lot of the reading. We play games. We watch how each other play games to figure out how people actually engage with them, what kinds of things people do. And we start off with Twine. I don't know if you've used that at all.
I'm not familiar with it, but I'm not sure if my listeners will be familiar with it. Could you kind of briefly describe what it is?
Okay, Twine is a, you can find it at twinery.org. And it is a environment for creating interactive fiction. If you remember the old Choose Your Own Adventure books, at its simplest, a Twine can be rather like that, but you can add JavaScript to it. You can do quite clever things with loops and variables and so on. And for students who've never engaged with thinking algorithmically in the first place, it is close enough to being like writing an essay that it doesn't feel too scary, but it is far enough away from that that it starts fostering these habits of thought about how you generate an argument at one step remove, right? So oral historians talk about sharing authority with the people that they interview in order to write history. In this class, we talk about sharing authority with the algorithm that somebody else has created in order to generate history through the emergent dynamic of the player interacting with the code. And so they start with that. And by the time we're done, they actually end up building Minecraft worlds that express good history.
All right. And that's always obviously a challenge because, as noted on this show before, you know, there's a difference definitely between, you know, archaeology in video games as almost like just a texture, like a retexture, and it's just a skinned thing placed upon, you know, standard mechanics. So what... Yeah. And that's obviously not what we want to do. We want to actually have something that's far more engaging. So, I mean, how do you see people becoming better at developing historical games? Because obviously there's a lot different between, like, for example, you know, you take a game like, I'm just trying to think of an RTS game, and, you know, like, I have, let's say, StarCraft. You know, imagine you modded StarCraft and you put it into, like, you put them into little Roman suits, but you still played them with the same mechanics in StarCraft. You know, it wouldn't be a historical game just because you put some Roman outfits on them.
No, it's the engagement has to happen at the level of the mechanic and the level of the code.
So what's a historical mechanic then?
Ah, well, that's the 79-cent question right there.
I've only got pence, so actually, wait, give me a second. I've got 40p. Is that worth 79 cents?
I did my grad school at Reading, and 40p would get you a cup of coffee in the junior common room, so...
Really? Jeez. What kind of coffee was that?
Well, it would take the enamel off your teeth, but other than that, it was good stuff.
Sorry, go on.
But, I'll tell you, one of the groups in the class were interested in Roman history and Roman archaeology. And so what they did was they recreated in Minecraft Kanina's 16th century map and imagining of Portus outside of Rome. So you've got a 21st simulacrum of a 16th century imagination of first century ruins. And they decided to deliberately mess with Minecraft's open world ethos by casting the player in the role of a dock slave, a warehouse slave at Portus. And so by putting that juxtaposition, by limiting the agency within a game where everybody knows you're supposed to be doing able to do anything, they were trying to make a larger point about slavery, Roman world, within that particular the patterns of articulated spaces and how that creates particular sorts of social interactions and where you can go and where you can't go and that kind of thing.
But surely that relies a little bit on a bit of prior knowledge, doesn't it?
Well, it's very rare you come to any topic completely cold.
That is true. Those are really quite fascinating things. So how can I get onto this course? Because this sounds actually, seriously, I want to do this. Do you have a long distance one? Please tell me you do.
I do it as openly as possible. That's a key part of the philosophy for my teaching, is that there's no point in doing work for an audience of one or an audience of zero. I mean, you have 40 students and they all write you an essay and you've got 4 days to grade them all. You're not really giving it your full attention, are you? So typically I'll use a blog to house everything. And as much as what I'm, a person could come to that blog and see all of the materials that I'm giving to students, all of the instructions I'm giving to students, all of the readings, all of the background, all of the ancillary stuff. The only thing they don't get is the Sean Graham show. But I would like to turn that particular course into a fully, officially online Carleton University course.
Well, you've definitely got a test subject over here, and I'm pretty sure there's quite a few listeners here who would also like to give it a shot.
Well, next year I will be teaching a fully online course on data visualization, big data, data mining, that kind of thing for history writ large. And so all and any archaeologists are more than welcome to take it. And the philosophy there is I'm putting it all up on GitHub, and I want people to fork the materials, to take their own, to improve it, to... again, you know, giving it away in order to retain control of it, if you see what I mean.
You know, it's really funny. I'm sure that anybody who hasn't used GitHub before does not know what the hell forking is. But it's basically... sorry, go on. You probably got a better explanation.
I provide the initial bit of materials, and then as people copy it, they... and develop it in their own turn or adapt it or add to it, the material grows. So like a fork in a tree, different branches start splitting off. And the nice thing about GitHub is that a person can take a branch as far as they want and then say to the person who started it all, here, my stuff is really nice now, why don't you bring it back? And so the branches get merged and you get this crazy wickerwork thing happening over time. So it seemed to me that there's no point in building an online course that forces everybody into a walled garden where the outside world can't see what you're doing, can't interact with you, especially when we're talking about things like games or digital methods or public archaeology. I mean, that just doesn't make sense to my mind. So by putting it all on GitHub, I allow folks to take all of those materials. GitHub keeps track of where stuff goes, so it functions as a kind of citation. And we make it better, because Lord knows I've just picked this stuff up as I've gone along. It's not like anybody sits you down and trains you up in this stuff, although I guess that's now my job.
All right, we're here with Jordan Harbinger from theartofcharm.com again, and we're talking about the Art of Charm podcasts. And over the last month, we've had some people write in and comment about the Art of Charm, and they want to know a little more about it. So, Jordan, can you tell us a little more about what they can find on your podcasts?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that the term sort of like networking and relationship development is all vague and everything. So, basically, we focus on a lot of things, very broad topics. Our toolkits are focused on things like body language, eye contact, vocal tonality, business networking, negotiation, relationship management, etc. But we also branch into other topics like, I had a guy on the show named Brad Salas, a guest, and he talked about millennials and how they can relate to their bosses better, their boomer bosses, and how boomer bosses can relate to the new millennials better. Because as you can see in workplaces, those are guys are butting heads, and it's kids are so dumb these days, and it's old people don't get it. And it's just like, if we can bridge that gap, we can be more productive. So we gave a lot of practical exercises and steps to use that. We've also talked about how to burn fat while you're working with weird things like treadmill desks and being cold while you're working in the office to burn calories while you're just sort of being you working all day. And we cover hundreds of other things, but those are two kind of concrete examples of it.
Hey, and these are real world things you can use. I've actually turned the temperature down in my home office because of that podcast about just being cold, because it's something you can do that's easy.
Yeah, and there's plenty of guys out there listening to the show who bought these weird ice vests and they're sitting there freezing right now, but, you know, losing weight doing it. So we're weirdos, but we assume we're in good company.
That's right. Well, you can check out more from The Art of Charm at theartofcharm.com, and you can check out the podcasts on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and everywhere you download podcasts.
Thank you.
You mentioned, of course, public archaeology. Public archaeology is quite a big thing over here, definitely in the UK. And it looks to be something that's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. We on the An Archaeologist podcast actually consider public archaeology to be the future of archaeology. But not everybody agrees with us. Where would you say you lie on that point?
If you're not doing it for the public or in public, why the hell are you doing it?
Well, I'm glad we've got another recruit. Yes, the army gets bigger.
Well, you know, like the Day of Archaeology people have done a tremendous service in making what archaeologists do transparent and raising the profile. I mean, ultimately, all of the money that goes into archaeology is coming out of the public at, you know, one end or another. So it's a shame that it doesn't have the prestige. Is that the right word?
Possibly. I think I know what you mean. Yeah. The kind of the public value, the kind of immediate kind of like, yeah, value and intrigue that it warrants.
Yeah. But I mean, there's public in the sense of things that are good for you. And then there's public in the sense of things that the public actually reads and wants. Right? It's like the Times versus the Sun.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And it's, and there's a lot of space to be negotiated there and a lot of thinking and work that needs to be done.
But that's another part of being an archaeologist, isn't it? I mean, we're all about mediation. I think archaeology for me is it's almost like a meta subject. It's almost in some ways a way of life. And what it means is you don't kind of, at the end of the day, kind of put, you know, take off your hat and hang your whip up on the wall. You know, you kind of, you engage all the time. And I really love to see people online kind of, you know, continuing and to put stuff out there like you do. I think that's really great. I mean, that's the kind of direction I'm coming from in with regard to public archaeology, because it's one of those things that really, I think, we need to hear, the public needs to hear from about archaeologists from archaeologists, not like through special kind of delivery systems, you know, like only through like TV shows or only in museums. You know, archaeologists are everywhere, and
yeah,
what they mean.
Well, I did a project in 2011, and then again in 2014, I tried to map the archaeological blogosphere and figure out whether or not we're just talking to each other, whether we're shouting to the void, or whether or not we're actually reaching people. And I mean, people like Lorna Richardson and Colleen Morgan do similar kinds of things. And there's, as far as digital archaeology goes, I've always told people that I consider digital archaeology to be a kind of public archaeology as well. In 2011, it was possible to get your message out there much clearer. When I mapped it again in 2014, the advertising web, the cruft, all those tendrils of trackers and ad servers and all that sort of thing, it's really quite parasitic on the underlying structure of the web, and it strangles it out. So, you know, to take another gardening metaphor, it's, I don't know whether to spread manure or get a blowtorch.
Well, I think we should holster our flamethrowers for the moment. I mean, they are a special item, so we'll need to go and find the fuel for them. But I think we should continue to like spread the love. At the Archaeology Podcast Network, we're always looking for more podcasts, actually. We're hoping to expand and to add more shows to our roster, and we'd love to have more people adding to the voices. Hopefully, I don't think we'll ever drown out the trackers, but, you know, we make a dent. But what do you think about people in certain circles? I mean, I know you said about it's not as clear now, but what about the interactions between archaeologists versus the interactions with the public?
Well, those are very strong. You can see that. And I think with the decline of commenting on blogs and the rise of Twitter in the same space, that kind of stuff, I think, seems to be going fairly strong. Although, frequently I despair when I'm on Twitter, when you see the bullshit that goes through. And, you know, especially, you know, here I sit, I'm a white middle-aged guy. It's easier for me to do and say things than it might be for somebody else.
Yeah, no, and that's something that, you know, people would think that the internet kind of got over, you know, like, oh, we're all anonymous on the internet, therefore everybody's got the equal chance. But when in reality, it's most likely white male, middle-class males who actually have access and have the time to do online stuff. You know, I remember writing a very long-winded essay about the use of possibly using modding on a base game to kind of help people reinterpret historical places. And I remember actually speaking to somebody who was quite knowledgeable on kind of like, you know, kind of like digital access and things like that. And, you know, they were pointing out to me that, you know, while yes, you can make it available on the internet for everyone, there's still the problem of who gets to access the internet. And that's always something to think about, isn't it, when we're doing this online stuff, about where we get, where our outreach goes.
Well, this is it. And there's just been published this week, I think, a profoundly important piece by Sarah Perry, Lucy Shipley, and Jim Osborne in Internet Archaeology, issue 38. On digital media power and inequality in archaeology and heritage. And, you know, one of the things that they draw out there is archaeologists abusing each other on the web. And the experience of this and how it, you know, often it's people you actually know in the real world too, who are doing this to each other. And it's, and you know, and it's completely gendered as well. It's,
That is a shame, you know.
You know, we got to clean up our own house before we can go too much further.
No, you're completely right, and it's such a shame because, like I you know, my foray into online archaeology has actually been as long as this show has been around, because before August 2014, I didn't feel I had a reason to actually interact because I didn't have anything. You know, there was nothing, like my hands were empty. And when I started doing the show, that's kind of what gave me the impetus to kind of say, hey, I've actually, you know, I'm interesting, guys. But what I've noticed actually on my Twitter feed is that a lot of the archaeologists I follow are actually women. And like, I didn't notice it until somebody like kind of asked me, because we were talking about gender and different places, and you know, they'd asked me, like, in archaeology, what's the balance like? And I said, well, I've always found it, you know, on the level of archaeologists, very, very balanced, even almost like tipped slightly towards women. And I've noticed actually my Twitter feed's quite full of really, really great archaeologists who so happen to be women. And I think archaeology is one of those subjects that definitely at the kind of, you know, at the base level, or, you know, before you get into like higher academic positions, is actually quite well balanced. But that's just my view, you know. I could be blind to the real prejudices going on, you know.
Well, it's certainly, yeah, I think in the, as the profession grays, it becomes more and more male, and the reasons for that don't necessarily reflect very well on the profession, I think.
Yeah, no, it is one of those issues. I mean, how do you think we can change that? What can we do?
Oh, bloody hell. well, you know, in my current position, my title is not as an archaeologist.
Okay.
I had to completely reinvent myself, right? And it's only in this weird world of academia that you can be 40 years old and be the junior guy.
Yeah, no, it is.
But in order, in terms of, I have no good answer.
That's okay. Not
say, but only just. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're completely right, though. I don't think there is one singular answer. I think that's the biggest problem. There's no one singular, non-complex answer.
And I mean, my own particular trajectory through this field and into this current position is just so weird and odd. Students will ask me what they should do, and I'll be like, well, whatever you do, don't do what I did. And they'll say, well, what did you do? And I'll say, well, I kind of just bumped from thing to thing, ricocheting, you know, like there's, yeah, I don't know.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of paths in archaeology, like other subject, like other areas of work. You have like certain paths, you know, like if you wanted to be, I don't know, a technician or engineer, you know, you do your apprenticeship, or you go and study, and then you go work, and then you get promoted, and you end up being like a floor shop manager, or, you know, you kind of get up to the point where you're creating new machines. I mean, but archaeology doesn't seem to have a pathway in terms of how you get there, because everybody comes from so many different places. Like, I started off as, I was a chemist about 5 years ago. I was a chemist, a pure chemist, at like studying chemistry, and, you know, I had nothing to do with archaeology. And then I took archaeology as an extra subject at uni, and here I am, you know. But that's obviously an issue when it comes to saying, well, how do I plan to become an archaeologist? How do I put the effort in? And there's no real answer to that either.
No. You have to be open to serendipity for part of it, but that's no good answer when you're staring $60,000 in student loans in the face or, you missed a payment and the research body has turned you over to a collection agency, which happened to a friend of mine.
But in saying that, what the situation does mean is that people from many, many different backgrounds come together through archaeology. You know, you're working with people who have come from backgrounds that maybe are programming or computer backgrounds. You've people coming from architectural backgrounds. You got people coming from all these different areas, and but they're all linked through archaeology. And I think that's a really great kind of way of looking at it. I just wanted to balance it out a little bit.
Well, that's it. I mean, I think for me personally, and speaking for, a sample of only one, I went through school. I did everything right. I did everything I was supposed to do. I did it on the timetable. And I got to the end of that in 2002, and I was pissed at the world. I felt I was owed something. I did everything that everybody asked me to do. I did it at personal cost. And at the end of it, there wasn't a damn thing. I was living out of my suitcase. I was living in the freaking motorway hotel on the M. Is it the M5 that goes through Reading?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I was living out on the motorway hotel and on the train every day to three different gigs trying to keep things going. And I was super pissed off at everybody in the profession, everybody more senior than me, everybody more junior than me, everybody who sneered at me when I was at grad school as a foreigner because I was paying the fees and they weren't, and I was clearly had bought my way into the program. And it took a long time to get over that. And so there were two key things that happened for me. One was being a substitute teacher at a high school and then a one-year contract to cover somebody else who'd had a breakdown working with a particular program. And working with those kids whom nothing had ever worked for them. I had one student say to me, "Sir, I haven't passed a math quiz since I was in grade 4, 10 years previous." Working with those kids got me out of myself and started making me realize, okay, I have this archaeological way of looking at the world, but it doesn't look as if archaeology as a profession or a life is going to be for me. And that was the first part of the transformation, right? I had to get over myself. And the second part was the blogging and was starting to explore and play digital work and just giving away what I was doing because I wasn't being paid. Nobody was asking me to do this. Nobody asked me to sit down and figure out how to do topic modeling or whatever. And giving that away started giving me a position where I could start saying stuff because there were few voices. Right. So I was by no means the best voice to listen to, but there was stuff that people could find. And when eventually things started shifting in academia and in the world more generally, I was positioned all of a sudden to actually say in good conscience, actually, I can do that. That is, I am the person you are looking for. These are the droids you are looking for. in 94, I was an undergrad and I wrote a paper on why the web would never be useful for academics. So,
wow, really? Do you know that actually sounds like I remember having lost, having a hard disk crash on me and getting a replacement made me go back and through all my hard disks. And I guess that sounds very much like, you know, the poetry you write when you're like 13 and it's really edgy. Yeah. No, I can imagine your paper on how the internet can never be used.
Well, you know, it's sometimes you get that assignment from a prof and you're just so angry about it that you want to stick it to the prof for making you do this stupid thing in the first place. Yeah, well, this was class on Etruscans, and the assignment was go onto the web and make an annotated bibliography of what you find. So I went to Alta Vista, and I typed in Etruscans, and the first thing that came up was the Sex Communist Manifesto.
Oh my goodness.
I sat down to write about what a waste of time this whole web thing was. I conceded that email might possibly be useful.
Oh, well, at least you were forward-thinking in that way.
Yeah. So basically, that's by way of disclaimer about everything I've said here this afternoon could well be full of crap.
No, I really enjoyed listening to a lot of what you've had to say. That's actually really fascinating. I think you're probably the first guest I've had on that's actually we've had this kind of. I feel we've had a connection, Sean. I feel we have a connection, but obviously. It's
electric.
It is. Oh. And you could say we have a chemistry between us. another thing that I like to say is all archaeologists like bad jokes. I don't know if you ever... what do you think of that? Do you agree or disagree? All archaeologists.
I have published a paper called Rolling Your Own. So.
Oh, dear.
There you go.
One of your recent blog things was on hearing the past, and obviously I'm very interested in that because obviously this is all about hearing and what people can hear. But obviously it's something a little different than what I'm thinking. So can you tell us a little bit about hearing the past, the blog post recently on electric archaeology?
That hearing the past is a paper that I'm writing with Stu Eve, Colleen Morgan, and Alexis Pantos. Stu, Eve, and I, a while ago, were playing around with a piece of code from Ed Summers, who's a digital archivist, and he coded up this thing called EC, which pulls from Wikipedia all of the pages within a kilometer of your location, and it shows which ones are complete, which ones aren't, and so on and so forth. And I started feeding that through a music algorithm because I wanted to make that digital layer thick. The idea being that you would be listening to this kind of ambient techno music, and when the digital layer in that physical place started getting heavier and heavier, the music would become more and more abrasive and abrupt and terrible and noisy and cause you physical pain. So you would have to stop, and it would actually force you to look at where you were with new eyes. Or conversely, places that were thin, you know, why isn't this place important in the digital world? I've been interested in aspects of augmented reality for a while, but augmented reality through a smartphone or through a tablet is clunky and gimmicky and shite.
That's a very good way of putting it. I must say, I couldn't have put it any better myself.
Well, I've got shaky hands to begin with, and I can't keep the damn camera focused. So, but this is the other thing, right? All this digital stuff privileges people with good sight, physical mobility, hands that work, you know, and sound actually can be more effective and effective when you start looking into the cognitive connections between sound and memory and emotion. So we started playing with that, and Stu wired it into a computerized voice emulator thing. And so now you get all of these, we called it historical friction, and all of these voices overlay and start shouting at you in these thick places. At the Heritage Jam at York last year, Stu and company took that bass gimmick that we built and adapted it to the York Cemetery so that you know, plague pits and mass graves that have no stone clamor for your attention when you hear all of these voices interred within, whereas the monstrous monument that only has one person in it has only one small voice telling you the story. So they called it voices recognition. And we were invited to a unconference at Brock University on seeing the past. And so in typical contrary fashion, we began with, you can't see the past. The past is gone, but you might be able to hear it. So that piece on the blog is our contribution to that conference, which eventually will be published in an open access volume. And I'm really getting quite interested in these other ways of merging the digital with the physical that don't concentrate on sight. Stu's PhD thesis, Dead Man's Eyes, on embodied GIS, is a tremendous piece that I would encourage everybody to pick up, British Archaeological Reports. And, you know, I have a student named Hollis who is in a motorized wheelchair, and he would come to class, and the accessible access to our lecture theater actually opened up onto the podium where I was. And I kept putting the damn chair in front of that door, and I would block it before Hollis could come in. And I smartened up eventually. And Hollis and I have been working together on a number of different things since then. And seeing the kind of crap that Hollis has to put up with in order to study, in order to get the readings for a class. I said to him one afternoon, I said, yeah, you should go to one of these unconferences. They're really great. People sit down and propose things to talk about, and they build stuff together, and all this wonderful stuff happens. And he looked at me and said, if they're so damn easy, why don't we do one? So we called Bluff, and we ended up hosting an unconference on accessibility. And we recorded all of the conversations that were happening, because we were also simultaneously broadcasting it through an accessible web system to people who couldn't physically be there. And Hollis has since been analyzing those transcripts with data mining and sentiment analysis and different things. And, you know, the division between people who are interested about digital media and physical accessibility versus those interested in open access, there was such a huge cleft there between the two. And if open access means anything, it's got to mean accessibility in terms of physical accessibility as well. So, you know, working with Hollis has been one of the great things about my time here at Carleton. And so, yeah, that hearing the past, it comes out of that whole milieu.
That's so fascinating. That story's great. I love this. This is fantastic. I must say, though, when you were talking about the voices getting louder and louder till you know, you had to stop listening, I might have a higher than normal tolerance for that, you know, because some of the music I listen to is quite, I don't know how to put it in a nice way, harsh, or very brutal, there we go. So actually, you know what, I might find myself liking the loud crescendos of sound. I will have to definitely check some of that stuff out.
It works best on Chrome on the desktop, which kind of undermines the whole point, but I'm a crap coder.
Oh, so okay.
if somebody would like to fork it and make it work better, I would be eternally excited about that.
Well, thank you very, very much for coming on the show. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for asking.
I don't think we actually had a topic at the end there, but I think, you know, for the entire show, I think it was just basically a conversation with yourself. And that's sometimes what you just need.
Yeah.
Well, if anybody wants to check out your blog, they go to...
electricarchaeology.ca.
All right. Thank you very much for everybody listening. Thank you to my guest. And if you're interested in other shows, as usual, you can head over to the Archaeology Podcast Network for more information. So in the meantime, get forking, get on GitHub, and remember, you can't see the past, but you certainly can hear it here on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks.
Fail big or go home.
That was fantastic.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.